After months of political and legal wrangling, the British Parliament has approved a plan for deporting asylum seekers all the way to Rwanda. It's still deeply controversial.
You cannot send someone to a country where they could face risk of death, of torture, or of other irreparable harm.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the Israeli military has stepped up operations in the West Bank. Palestinians say innocent people are paying the price. We'll hear the story of one Palestinian family whose young son was killed.
And a nonprofit in New York City is offering a touch of kindness to new migrants.
They're valued customers and not a problem to be solved or a charity case.
All that and much more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. Stop the boats. That has been a political rallying cry in Britain for the past few years. And the boats in question are small vessels, often inflatable, filled with migrants and asylum seekers, crossing the English Channel in order to get into the United Kingdom.
Last night, British lawmakers passed a controversial plan to deport people arriving on small boats or by any other irregular means to the African nation of Rwanda. Joelle Grogan has studied this issue carefully. She's the head of research at a think tank in London called UK and a Changing Europe. I spoke with her earlier and asked how this new deportation plan would work.
For asylum seekers arriving in the UK, they will be given a deportation order telling them that they'll be sent to Rwanda, where their claim for refugee status will be processed there, and if they're successful under Rwandan law, they'll stay there as refugees.
Now, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said yesterday that the deportations to Rwanda will begin within 10 to 12 weeks.
No ifs, no buts. These flights are going to Rwanda.
What does he say this policy will accomplish?
He believes it will be a very powerful deterrent, stopping illegal migration, stopping the boats from coming to the UK. The challenge that he's placed himself by saying it will immediately act as a deterrent and stop all boats is it's not been proven anywhere that the domestic legal policies actually change refugees and asylum seekers' minds as to where they go.
So why Rwanda? The geography here seems to be quite counterintuitive.
The underlying law has identified 57 countries worldwide that are considered safe. However, of the 57 countries that the UK has said are safe for asylum seekers, only one country has signed up to an agreement, Rwanda.
So it's a legal matter.
Exactly. Rwanda is the only country that has agreed to accept asylum seekers. The majority of countries listed as safe are EU and European countries that have their own migration challenges and are not willing to accept more asylum seekers, or countries that are not necessarily safe for everyone. For example, 8 of the countries the UK identified are considered safe only for men.
The head of the European Court of Human Rights has warned the UK government about this legislation. What are they saying?
One of the core principles of international human rights law, and this is for every country, including the US and Canada that have signed up to this, is the idea of non-refoulement, or non-refoulement, if you have a nice English accent. That principle is that you cannot send someone to a country where they could face risk of death, of torture, or of other irreparable harm. The reason that the Rwanda policy was considered unlawful by the UK Supreme Court was looking at this principle and saying that the people who had previously been sent to Rwanda by, for example, Israel, when they had a similar deal in 2013, actually were sent back ultimately to countries that they came from in violation of this principle. The core concern is that asylum seekers sent to Rwanda could be returned to their countries of origin and again suffer that irreparable harm, potentially death, potentially torture, or potentially other severe harms.
And you mentioned skepticism on this, but is there evidence that this plan will deter migrants from trying to get into the UK?
The Home Office, so the government departments responsible for this policy, said that it is unproven at best. We cannot find any academic research that supports the idea that domestic policies actually change people's minds. For asylum seekers and for migrants, when they're looking at which countries to go to, they'll look at community, they'll look at language, they'll look at culture. Or for many of them that are subject to criminal gangs and criminal organization, they don't have a choice. They're simply dumped in a country.
Rishi Sunak reportedly was also skeptical about this Rwanda deportation plan previously, but now he's pushing for it. What are the politics that are playing out here?
We are coming into a major general election. The Conservative Party have been in power for a significant amount of time, and they're looking at current polling as dire at best. So for the Prime Minister here in the UK, giving the impression that he is controlling migration, he's controlling illegal, as he calls it, or irregular migration, is something he thinks will boost him in the polls.
So what happens if a new government comes in and tries to roll back this legislation? Is it just going to be, you know, thrown out in a couple of months?
The official opposition, the Labour Party, that just on the basis of current polling is very likely to be the next government, has said publicly that they would take back or they'd repeal the Rwanda policy. However, what's interesting is they haven't said anything about the underlying law. It is possible that they will look to other countries, potentially other European countries, or even further afield, to try and find a safe country in a way similar to Rwanda. But again, safety will be the key term there.
So you mentioned that this is in the context of an election year, of course. Is this policy popular with voters?
It's controversial. And what we've seen from polling is that the population are divided at best. In fact, a lot of the changes that the House of Lords, part of the UK Parliament, wanted to see to the bill were far more popular than the bill itself. For example, giving exception to Afghani interpreters who had helped UK armed forces, which the government ultimately rejected, was very, very popular among the population. But as a policy, it's not overall popular.
Joelle Grogan is with the London-based think tank UK in a Changing Europe. She was updating us on the British government's plan to start sending migrants and asylum seekers to Rwanda.
It's only Tuesday, but it's been a tough week so far for TikTok. Congress passed a bill that could lead to the video sharing app getting banned in the U.S. Europe is cracking down, too, on TikTok and a spinoff platform called TikTok Lite. That version, available in Japan, France, and Spain, actually pays users for watching videos. The more time you spend on TikTok Lite, the more you earn. Health officials, though, are sounding the alarm on addiction, and European leaders are demanding answers. From Barcelona, the world's Jerry Haddon reports.
You could always go on normal TikTok to watch, say, user PaulPaulJohn4194 trying to toss Mentos into a bottle of soda. Or you could do the same and earn virtual coins on TikTok Lite. Paul Paul nails it, then clamps his mouth over the bottle, sucking in the foaming soda, his face turning bright red, while you take that to the bank. That's TikTok Lite. Everyone wins, says one really excited Spanish YouTuber named Feli King. It's totally nuts, he told his 150,000 followers earlier this month, just after TikTok Lite launched in Spain. They will literally pay you to watch videos, he said. You'll accumulate more and more coins for as long as you can hang in there. TikTok Lite says you can cash in those coins to buy stuff via PayPal or on Amazon. You get 150 coins for every minute you're connected, says this TikToker, Les Gens d'Internet, in France. And if you connect every day for 10 straight days, she says, you get a bonus. The hype is high, but so far TikTok itself has been silent. The company did not respond to an interview request, nor has it said how many downloads TikTok Lite has had in its first month. But it says it created the app to reach people in remote parts of the world where internet and cell phone coverage are weak. The Lite in TikTok Lite refers to the new app's smaller bandwidth. But as TikTok seeks to expand its market, it risks losing one big one, Europe. The European Commission has been sounding the alarm about potential risks associated with the original TikTok.
We have already launched proceedings, formal proceedings against TikTok on the grounds of the question of addictive or potentially addictive behavior.
That's Johannes Barke, a spokesman for the European Commission. The EC opened its case against TikTok in February, accusing it of failing to keep kids off its platform. TikTok Lite, with its watch and reward system, is under even harsher scrutiny. It launched this month without presenting a risk assessment for things like mental health and addiction, as required by law. According to commission officials, TikTok claims to have the assessment in hand, but says it hasn't been able to share it for technical reasons. Weeks have passed and nothing.
So TikTok has been given a deadline of 24 hours to do this, on the grounds of protection of minors and the mental health of users.
That deadline came and went today, and still TikTok isn't talking. The commission has now given TikTok until Wednesday to explain itself. If it doesn't, the commission says it will suspend the rewards part of the app and freeze its coins. It would be the first such penalty against a social media platform since Europe passed a strict new law governing online services last August. Mental health workers here in Spain welcome the crackdown. Therapist Janira Becerril says more and more adolescents are grappling with screen time addiction.
Menos bienestar emocional, menos integración social, menos satisfacción vital.
The symptoms, she says, include a lack of emotional well-being and belonging, dissatisfaction with life, and a rise in anxiety and depression. Becerril works at a clinic in Barcelona called Centra Bonanova. She says TikTok Lite is following the formula of other popular apps and online games like Fortnite or Candy Crush. You're being rewarded, she says, whether it's with virtual tokens or with more time on the platform. And it's all designed to give users' brains a big old hit of dopamine, the neurotransmitter associated with reward and pleasure.
Mucho más predisponente y vulnerable a acabar desarrollando una adicción.
It leaves users, Becerril says, more and more vulnerable to becoming addicted.
Lo que puedes hacer es canjearla en tu cuenta oficial de TikTok por monedas.
As online influencers like the Spaniard Feli King tout TikTok Lite as an easy get-paid side hustle, well, it doesn't pay very much. For a full hour engaged on TikTok Lite, a user earns well under a dollar. Should Europe suspend this reward system, TikTok Lite stands to lose a whole lot more than its customers. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Okay, here is how you turn one of the most annoying parts of going to the beach, seagulls, into something pretty adorable.
In Belgium this week at the annual European Gull Screeching Championships, 9-year-old Cooper Wallace faced the competition dressed head to toe in a seagull costume. Cooper wowed the judges with this seagull impression.
3, 2, 1.
It is so hard to believe that that is a human. Wallace went on to nail the prompt to mimic a specific kind of gull, the kind that will dive bomb your sandwich.
A seagull that is hungry.
In that video from the BBC, the costume boy is beaming. He flaps his gray winged arms and the crowd roars.
The competition is lighthearted, but the event does have a higher calling.
Yeah, Jan Says is a marine biologist. He was in charge of the judging panel and told the Guardian newspaper that seagulls are maligned as rats of the sea. But actually, they're an important part of coastal ecosystems, an important part of the competition, the tallying of scores. 92 points total, and Cooper Wallace comes in first place in the junior category.
He said his friends used to think his seagull impression was annoying, but not anymore.
I feel like somebody just took my French fries. Coming up, we step inside a shop in New York City where a little kindness goes a long way for newly arrived immigrants. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Swiss food giant Nestle is under fire. A new report says some of its most popular products for infants and toddlers have different levels of sugar depending on where they are sold. Put more bluntly, the same product in Western Europe has no sugar, but in some low or middle income countries, it does contain sugar. Manuel Abebe is co-author of the report published by Public Eye, a Swiss investigative watchdog group.
So we looked at two main selling brands of Nestle. We looked at Cerelac, which is a baby cereal designed for babies from 6 months. And we looked at Nido, which is the so-called growing up milk aimed at kids from one and above. And what we found is that for Cerelac, so the baby cereals, there is on average across all products, we looked at 1 teaspoon of added sugar preserving. And for Nido, the trend is a little bit less pronounced, but still we're talking about 2 grams of added sugar per serving in these products.
Right. And how big an increase is that from what we should expect?
Well, we should expect 0 grams of added sugar. This is the guideline of the WHO, so the World Health Organization. They say themselves that there is no room for any added sugar in baby food product for children up to 3 years of age. And we also found that the same type of product in Switzerland, in Germany, in UK, so across European countries, doesn't contain any added sugar. But we see that in countries with lower and with middle income, Nestle has still decided to add these kinds of sugar in these products.
Has Nestle responded to your report?
Yeah, they have responded to a report. They say that they will remove at some point the added sugar from the Nido product lines or from the milks. And for Cerelac, they haven't really given any target in reducing. So they said that in the past, they have already reduced to some extent the added sugar. But still, this is just not enough from our point of view. And so that's also why we are calling on Nestle to just stop any added sugar in its baby food products for children up to 3 years of age.
What are you hearing from countries where Nestle's products contain extra sugar?
Well, we've had big reactions, notably from India, where this kind of double standard was widely criticized in the media. And actually, the government has opened an investigation into our findings. We've also had similar responses from Bangladesh. We have government responses from countries in Africa, such as Nigeria. And we also see that there are, for example, in the Philippines, there is currently a law pending in the Senate where they want to ban any added sugar from baby foods. And so we hope that these kinds of discussions now really get spurred on and that countries themselves also take regulatory measures into their own hands and ban these types of added sugar.
Are there certain lower-income countries where these Nestle products do not contain sugar?
Well, so we looked at 150 products around 30 countries. And for the Cerelac product, we found that 94% of them have added sugar. So, I mean, there is a small percentage of product that doesn't have added sugar, but these are often not the main lines promoted by Nestle itself. So there is some choice, but really there isn't, because as I said, 94% of the products contain added sugar.
Yeah, outline for us the essential harms to health when we're talking about sugar getting into the diets of infants and young kids.
Adding sugar at that age, it sets children up for a lifelong diet of sweet foods, of ultra-processed foods. So the likelihood of a child that has had high exposure to added sugar in infancy will be much higher than also to lead into overweightness and obesity. And once you start talking about obesity, you start also talking about linked diseases such as hypertension, diabetes, potentially cancer, and so on. So this is really a big concern if added sugar that wouldn't have any place in these kind of foods is added to them.
Manuel Abebe is co-author of a report looking into the sugar content of certain Nestle foods for infants and toddlers. We reached out to Nestle for comment but did not hear back in time for air.
Over the past 2 years, nearly 180,000 migrants have come to New York City. That marks a huge increase in the rate of new arrivals. According to the mayor's office, New York has spent more than $2 billion on food, shelter, and basic necessities needed by migrants starting from scratch. But the gaps remain significant. Some local New Yorkers are stepping in to help. The World's Bianca Hilliard takes us to the Little Shop of Kindness.
It's a blustery and unseasonably cold spring morning when I arrive at the Little Shop of Kindness on New York's Upper East Side. But the atmosphere is warm and welcoming as soon as I enter the building and take the elevator up to the shop.
Third floor.
Yeah.
Not that one you did before.
Children are coloring and playing with toys in the waiting area. Ilza Thielman snakes her way through the crowded store to greet me.
Hi, Ilza. So nice to meet you, Bianca. Welcome.
Thielman is the founder of the shop. It's run by volunteers who aim to provide migrants with anything they need. To start, that means offering intangible support from volunteers like Blanca Del Moral.
I speak Spanish, English, and Google. And Google Translate.
Del Moral says people come from countries all over the world. Morocco, China, Russia, and Ecuador, to name a few. She asks them if their children are enrolled in school, if they have health insurance, and if they know how to apply for asylum or temporary protected status. She feels compelled to volunteer at the shop, she says, because her own parents were immigrants from Mexico and Puerto Rico.
They had very little, but the little that they had, they would always be willing to share with other people, and I just grew up the same way.
Customers then get assigned a personal shopper who helps them find toiletries, shoes, and clothes in their style and size. I follow volunteer Jeanette Ray Stathrop as she helps two teenagers from Colombia. She holds up a medium-sized T-shirt, and one teen says no, he needs a bigger size. Then Dathrop asks another teen if floral patterns fit her style. Founder Ilza Thielman says this kind of service is what the shop is all about.
We want to treat them with the utmost dignity and respect. We want this to feel like a boutique. We want this to feel like they're valued customers and not a problem to be solved or a charity case.
Many of the people who come to the Little Shop of Kindness are living in city-run shelters or on the streets. I speak with one customer, Katis, who asks that we only use her first name out of concern for her asylum case.
Pues, mi país, la situación no es muy bien y pues trataron de...
Katie says she left her home country of Venezuela a year ago because of government corruption and worry about her family's safety. Her time in New York has been filled with ups and downs, she says. She managed to get a job and was about to rent an apartment with her husband and 7-year-old son. But then she got injured, had to leave her job, and they were forced to remain in a shelter. She says all of the attention she's gotten at the Little Shop of Kindness has been great, and she's happy to be walking away with clothes for the whole family. For volunteer Blanca Del Moral, that will do for now.
As long as we get a smile out of people as they're walking out, that makes all of us happy.
The Little Shop of Kindness serves about 100 people per day. It's open 4 days a week, and appointments can be made online. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, New York.
France is hosting the Summer Olympics. One of its poorest districts is seeing all kinds of new construction. But some of the locals are less than thrilled.
When I see the price of real estate in my area, that you build new building not for the poor people, it's not my Olympic Games.
Olympics gentrification still ahead on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Biden administration is reportedly considering new sanctions against an Israeli army battalion. It's accused of committing human rights violations against Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called this the height of absurdity, and he vowed to oppose any U.S. sanctions against the Israel Defense Forces.
There has been a dramatic and deadly rise in hostilities between Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank. I recently had the chance to meet with one family at their home in the Palestinian village of Burin. There may not be army tanks on the highways in the West Bank, but there is another war here that's being fought between Israelis and Palestinians. This is the home of Mohammed Najjar, his wife Salam, and their three children. It overlooks an olive orchard, which is bordered by a highway built primarily as a convenience for the Israeli settlers in the West Bank. The Najjar house is surrounded by a heavy-gauge steel fence. When I asked Mohammed Najjar about it, he said he put it in last year when settlers living nearby attacked his house. They torched the two entrances, then blew up a gas canister. They also killed a couple of sheep. It's just one incident, says his wife Salam Najjar, that has led her to take an abundance of caution to protect her children. The settlers are always around, so I make my kids play inside the house, she says. It's not big, but I have to let them play soccer indoors. And then March 4th happened. Here's Mohammed Najjar. I had gone to a nearby town to get my phone repaired, he says, and on the way back, I got a call from my wife telling me there were Israeli soldiers on patrol in our town. With Najjar in the van were two of his sons, Amr and younger brother Ahmad. As we were driving into Burin, I could hear shooting, says Najjar. I stopped, but I could not locate where the sound was coming from. Cars were passing me, he says, and I thought it was safe to drive ahead. Then the cars came back, so I parked and waited. As soon as I stopped, we were shot at. The shot came from in front of us. Amr was killed. Moments later, he says, he saw where the bullet came from. It came from an Israeli military jeep, he says, 50 meters away. At that point, he explains, I got out of the car and started shouting, Amr has been martyred. That's when the jeep pulled towards us, he says, and stopped 20 meters from our van. Things then became very chaotic. Najjar went on. People came over to help us, to take Amr's body in another car to the hospital. It all happened in a matter of minutes. Amr's mother, Salam, adds, they could see it was a child in a van. He was killed with no justification whatsoever. My request for an interview with the IDF about the incident was declined. Instead, the IDF confirmed they had troops in Burin on March 4th, conducting a, quote, counter-terrorism activity, and that they responded with live fire when confronted with rock throwers. The statement then goes on to say that a Palestinian miner, Amr Najjar, died and that, quote, the circumstances of the incident were examined and it was found that the boy was hit by a stray bullet. On the day I visited the Najjar family, I also had an appointment to meet the mayor of Burin, Ibrahim Omar Abu al-Amir, but he had to cancel because at that moment he was stuck at an Israeli checkpoint. He agreed to chat briefly by phone. The Palestinians in the West Bank, we suffer from a lack of stability, a lack of security, he told me, a lack of movement. Look, I'm in Nablus, he said, 10 minutes away, and I've been at this checkpoint for an hour. The mayor explained that Burin is flanked by three Jewish settlements, and those settlers, he says, attack us, supported by the army. And since October 7th, those attacks have increased on our people and our livestock. The mayor needed to go. He said it was getting increasingly tense at the checkpoint where he was, but he made one more comment. Every time our families know one of us has to go through these Israeli checkpoints, it's like we're bidding them farewell forever. You never know, he says, when a stray bullet could end your life. It's been nearly 2 months since the death of the Najjar's oldest child, 10-year-old Amr.
Amr is the fastest.
That's a video his mother Salam made of him learning English.
So it's just been a little over a month. When you hear that, when you see that video, what does that do to you?
If I'm alone, I collapse, she said. When I'm with my kids, I stay strong. I ask her how her other three children are coping. Ahmad is traumatized, she said. He feels guilty that if he hadn't insisted on going with his dad to the phone repair store, Amr wouldn't have wanted to go. But she explained that she took him aside and told him it's not because of you. Salam told me that it's very important for her to make her son feel secure. And where I asked her, does she get the strength to make her family feel secure against the settlers and army that have attacked them? They may feel they're the stronger party, she replies, but we know through our faith that we will defeat them. The other thing that both Salam, her husband, Mohammed, and the mayor of Burin all say, without the intervention of the United States and Europe, nothing in the West Bank will change.
After a specific type of palm tree was cut down in a Ugandan forest, chimpanzees, antelopes, and monkeys all had to turn to a different food source. Bat poop. Sounds gross, of course, but there's also a bigger implication here. Scientists discovered that that poop was laden with viruses. It was another piece of evidence showing how deforestation is linked to the spread of disease. Pawel Frederick led a new study on this. It was published this week in the journal Nature.
This is what we believe happened. So raffia palm was the primary, or at least a very important source of dietary minerals, and that palm was exterminated locally because it was used to dry tobacco leaves, which were then sold to international tobacco companies. And since then, we observed the tree species feeding on guano, likely because this important source of minerals, the raffia palm, was exterminated. And unfortunately, bad guano also contains bad viruses. So guano consumption exposes animals who feed on it to the viruses residing there, and therefore increasing virus spillover risk.
Spillover into, for example, humans. Is there any evidence that any of the animals that ate this bat guano actually got sick from the viruses?
We don't know yet that. We haven't observed any dead chimpanzees during that time. This is something we would like to do in the future. This is one of the steps we are taking towards to investigate that topic in more detail, looking at health consequences of guano consumption, because guano contains lots of good things, such as dietary minerals, but we also know that, unfortunately, they contain less good things, potentially deadly things, such as viruses.
And you found, what I understand, 27 viruses in this guano, and one of them was a coronavirus related to SARS-CoV-2, correct?
That is correct. So in total, we identified 27 viruses in the guano, one of which being a novel beta coronavirus, which is, as you said, related to the infamous viruses, including SARS-CoV and SARS-CoV-2 that caused the recent COVID-19 pandemic. But it's not the same virus, and we didn't find any evidence that it could infect humans or the tree species. Even though, again, more research is basically needed to see which species this virus could infect.
You know, of course, a major worry here underpinning your research is that these viruses might eventually make their way into humans. I know that there are at least two viruses that have been documented making their way into humans that have been linked to deforestation. Can you describe, you know, how that would happen in this case, if it would, knowing that that is not what you documented in this study?
Well, this is one of the possibilities. Considerably more research is needed into the topic to investigate how forest deforestation and other forms of human activity can alter animal behavior or wildlife's behavior in a way that exposes them and humans to dangerous viruses. Basically, we do not yet fully understand the very early stages of virus spillovers, which can, as we know, can lead to the loss of hundreds of thousands of people, but they are believed to involve complex cause effects. So our study suggests that even a very subtle form or a forest degradation, such as removing from the forest floor just one plant species from the forest, can have a devastating consequences.
Pawel Frederick is the lead author of a new study linking deforestation and disease transmission. He's a professor at the University of Stirling in the UK.
For the past year, Sudan has been caught up in a devastating civil war. Two rival factions of the Sudanese military have turned their country into a battlefield. That is despite international efforts to bring an end to the fighting. Sudan's western Darfur region has seen some of the worst violence, which has led to the flight of hundreds of thousands of people from Darfur, seeking safety across the border with its western neighbor, Chad. Reporter Neha Wadakar has been speaking with some of them. She's just been to the refugee encampment in the eastern Chadian town of Adre. And a word of caution here, we'll be discussing some of the violence that Sudanese refugees have endured. Neha, first of all, who are the people in this camp you visited?
So these are people from all walks of life. I have spoken with doctors, lawyers, engineers,
people who had jobs just like we have, were living in nice homes, had great circumstances back in Sudan, and have had to flee and leave everything behind. And there are also people who are in far worse circumstances, people who were impoverished to begin with, low levels of education. So this is a crisis that really runs the gamut. Everybody is affected, and all kinds of people are showing up across the border here in Adre for safety.
And are they mostly from Darfur and Western Sudan because of the proximity to Chad, or are they from all across Sudan?
No, they're mostly from the Darfur region. That's right. And a lot of these people are coming across the border in a number of different ways. I will say the lucky ones are able to take vehicles across. But most of the people that we're talking to have come across in donkey carts, on horses, and some of them have even walked up to 4 or 5 days. I should say that the temperatures here are above 110 degrees. It is the hottest that I certainly have ever felt. At one point, actually, it was the hottest place in the world. I think that was last week.
Wow.
And so it is really, really devastating, devastating circumstances that people are enduring to get over here.
That sounds really tough. I mean, this conflict has been going on for over a year. What are you hearing from Sudanese refugees about what has changed for them?
I mean, the stories are absolutely horrible. A lot of the refugees that we've spoken to who fled earlier in the conflict, so we're at the 1 year mark of the conflict actually this month. So some of the people who were fleeing in the early days of the conflict were experiencing a lot of direct horrific violence, you know, attacks on villages, the burning of houses, mass shootings of people, of civilians, huge amounts of gender-based violence, rape and sexual assault. You know, we even heard stories of people who were being drowned in local rivers, their heads held underwater. That's what we were hearing from people who had fled in the beginning. Now, people are still fleeing violence, but they're also starting to flee from other issues, particularly hunger.
With these grim conditions, when the Sudanese first arrive in Abre, what kind of state are they in?
It is really tough. We actually visited the border point that marks the line between Sudan and Chad, and you see these donkey carts coming over piled up with women and children. Now, most of the people coming across the border are women and children. That is because in a lot of cases, the men have already been killed. So at the border crossing point that we were at, 72% of the new arrivals were children. They get registered with UNHCR, the United Nations Commission for Refugees. They're given rations cards so they can try to go and get food rations from the World Food Program. And then essentially they have to set themselves up in this encampment. It is not a formal refugee camp, which means that they have limited services here. The point of that is that the organizations do not want to encourage people to camp out here. It's very close to the border, which means they're in close proximity to the danger that they left behind. The overall goal of the UN agencies and other NGOs working in this area is ultimately to move people inwards a little bit away from the border into established refugee camps. Those camps are going to have more infrastructure, more semi-permanent housing, water, schools. But right now, the people that we're seeing in Adre have none of that.
And based on what you said, Neha, it sounds like that population is only going to increase. Do the organizations in charge, like the UNHCR, will they have the resources to accommodate all those people?
Well, they're under-resourced even as we speak. The budget for the Chad Refugee Response Plan, which includes funding for all humanitarian partners involved in the response, so UN agencies as well as NGOs, is $630 million. And Chad's part in this regional funding is only 4% funded. These are incredibly low numbers. And we know, obviously, there's a lot going on in other parts of the world. There is the conflict in Gaza. There's conflict in Ukraine. And that means that funding is stretched really, really thin. But a lot of the aid workers and humanitarians that I've spoken to say they have never seen such an underfunded crisis.
Yeah. To be clear, this camp is a transit point for those Sudanese who are there. What is their concern about the long term and whether they end up staying there in Chad?
I've heard two things from people. The first is that they have been through so much and they have seen so much trauma and so much bloodshed that all they care about right now is being in safety, which means being in Chad. Mm. They don't care whether they are in the transit camp or whether they are in an established camp. What they're most concerned about is keeping their families safe.
On the other hand, there are a lot of people who are feeling very disenfranchised, especially for the men who are traditional breadwinners in the family. They're not able to work. There's very, very little work available. In the formal refugee camps, there's even less, which is why a lot of people are actually trying to stay near this town of Adre, because at least there's some kind of labor jobs and small jobs that they can pick up to try to get something to feed their families. But, you know, a lot of the people are saying that they really want to go back to Sudan, that they are hoping that this is just temporary and they'll be able to cross the border when the situation gets calmer. But, you know, it's not looking like that's going to happen anytime soon.
Reporter Neha Wadekar is in Chad near the border with Sudan. She was updating us on the growing number of refugees there escaping the fighting in western Darfur in Sudan.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. France will host the Olympics this summer, and the country was chosen partly based on a promise to transform one of its poorest neighborhoods. The Paris suburb of Seine-Saint-Denis has a reputation for high unemployment and crime. Now it's home to the Olympic Village, a new aquatic center, and the National Stadium. But residents aren't sure all this change is for the good. From Paris, The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
It's Friday afternoon, and outside the town hall of Saint-Denis, a wedding party is getting underway. The bride, in an elaborate white dress, is dancing with her new husband. A wedding guest tells me the couple lives here in Saint-Denis, but their family are Kabyl, an ethnic group indigenous to northern Algeria. Saint-Denis is the district with the highest number of immigrants per capita in France. More than a third of the population here was born outside the country. Inside the town hall, I meet the mayor of Saint-Denis, Mathieu Hanotin.
Bonjour.
Enchanté. On y va?
Hanotin says he's all too aware of how his town is portrayed in international media.
C'est vrai que nous sommes dans un territoire qui connaît à la fois de grandes difficultés sociales, mais...
This area has many social problems, he says, but there are lots of other sides to Saint-Denis too. The Olympic and Paralympic Games are a fantastic chance for us to showcase this town, he says. After a terrorist attack in Paris in 2015, Fox News compared the district to a war zone.
Well, it was pretty scary. And I've been to Afghanistan, Iraq and Kashmir, India. And at times it felt like that, those places in the banlieue and these no-go zones.
The mayor of Paris threatened to sue the network, and the outlet later apologised. Mayor Hanotin says residents of Saint-Denis today are proud of their town, and particularly the fact that this area is where the heart of the Olympic Games will happen.
Ici, les habitants, ils ont envie des Jeux. Ils pensent aussi que les Jeux peuvent leur apporter
beaucoup. And they believe the Games will do a lot for the future of this town, he says. On the streets of Saint-Denis, though, not everyone is so enthusiastic.
Will you go to any of the Games?
This summer?
Yeah.
No. I go out of this area. And me...
This is Alexander Schoen. He's a history teacher who's lived in Saint-Denis for more than 10 years. Schoen says he loves the area, the multicultural vibe and the sense of community here. But he worries about the threat of gentrification that the Games could bring. Schoen is part of a group called Olympics 2024 Vigilance, made up mainly of concerned residents. We walk down a small back street lined with century-old brick houses, very different from the tower blocks that dot the landscape here. A woman appears at the door of one of the houses. I ask her how she's feeling about the games.
Comment je me sens? Je me sens un peu. On est coincé parce que on n'a pas le choix.
I feel stuck, she says, because we've no choice over what's happening. She tells me her name is Rosa Poulbeau and she's lived on the street for more than 30 years.
J'ai rien contre les JO. J'ai absolument rien contre les JO.
She says she's nothing against the Games, but she is against all the infrastructure that's being built up around them. She points to a huge motorway interchange that's just opened a short distance from her house.
J'ai beaucoup plus de bruit, beaucoup plus de poussière.
I've a lot more noise, a lot more dust, a lot more exhaust fumes coming into my house, she says, and cracks have started to appear on my ceiling. But the number of police in the area has also gone way up, Poulbeau says, and that's a good thing. Almost $5 billion is being invested in infrastructure for the Games, much of it in Saint-Denis. President Emmanuel Macron opened the new aquatic centre in the area earlier this month. And just a few minutes up the road from Poulbeau's house, the newly built Olympic Village is almost complete. Come July, it will house more than 14,000 athletes. Last year, French police drove out hundreds of migrants who were living in an abandoned building close to the village. More than 150 of them moved to another empty building in the southeast of Paris.
The building is on three floors, so you have rooms to the right and left.
Gilles Apprentice is a volunteer with the NGO United Migrants. The squat we're visiting is located in an industrial zone, far from any of the Olympic events. There are more than 450 people here, many from Sudan, Eritrea and Ethiopia. And some sleep 15 to a room.
But over time, it's become a real community. And so here, for example, is the barbers. So there's a phone number on the wall and people call and take an appointment and they come here and there's a mirror there and they have their barber's appointments in the building.
Prentice says more than 80% of the building's inhabitants have refugee status. And many of them have full-time jobs. But they can't find affordable housing, she says, or landlords who will accept them. No one wants to talk today, Prentice says, because they've just had word that the police are planning to come and clear out the building. And everyone's on edge.
Stressed, really stressed. Because on top of not knowing where they're going, they don't even know which day it's going to happen.
2 days later, local media report that dozens of police, some in riot gear, arrived at the building at 8 a.m. and evicted everyone. Back at the Olympic Village, Saint-Denis resident Alexander Schoen says it's just another example of how the state is turning its back on people with the greatest needs. After the games are over, the apartments in the Olympic Village are to be sold off. But Schoen says most local residents won't actually be able to afford them.
When I see the price of real estate in my area, that you build a new building not for the poor people, it's not my Olympic Games.
In the town hall, Mayor Mathieu Anatin says the plan for the Olympic Village apartments was never just about serving the local community.
Nous, on n'a pas de problème avec le fait que des gens de Paris ou d'ailleurs.
We have no problem with people from Paris or elsewhere coming to this area, he says. We want to encourage people from other parts of Paris and France to live here too. People of all social classes and all communities are welcome here, he says. The Olympic Games are for everyone. And so is Saint-Denis. As I leave the town hall, another wedding party has just arrived. For the world, I'm Orla Barry. Saint-Denis, France.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. As always, we'll see you right back here tomorrow.